welcome to Main Street 2025. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Happy New Year! Today, we're exploring intriguing stories and events from North Dakota and beyond. Coming up later in today's show, we'll highlight the Barnes County Historical Society's lecture series featuring Wes Anderson's A 16mm Film Fest. That's coming up in Valley City, and we'll journey to Taylor, North Dakota for the story of the restored Taylor Opera House. It's a remarkable community effort to preserve history. And Dr. Tom Ezern shares his fascinating tale of water witching on the Northern Plains in his latest Plains Folk essay, Second Sight. And we lead off our show on this Monday, the 1st of 2025, with a discussion about the Cinema 100 Film Society, a nonprofit organization dedicated to bringing diverse films to the Bismarck Mandan community. We have two guests today. I'll introduce them one by one. Brian Polacek is an organizer for the Cinema 100 Film Society that has been in existence for 50 years, and they have a wonderful line of movies beginning this Thursday at the Grand Theaters in Bismarck. Brian, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig. Nice to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you. And also a special guest, John Hansen, who in 1978 set out to produce a low-budget film in North Dakota chronicling the Nonpartisan League. It's a political movement in the early 1900s that sought to give farmers a voice in their own destiny. And its film, Northern Lights, was a surprise winner at the prestigious Cannes Film Festival in 1980. It will be in the second week of the Cinema 100 series this year. John, it's a pleasure to have you with us on Main Street. Welcome.
Great to join in, Greg. Thank you very much.
You're sure welcome. Let's start at the beginning. What is the Cinema 100 Film Society?
Well, Craig, it's a independent nonprofit arts organization, I would say, that focuses on film. And we were established in 1973. That's 52 years ago. And its function at that time was to bring to Bismarck films that people wanted to see, especially in, well, it started actually in the 1950s, and then it became inactive. And you can imagine there were these people who wanted to see films by Ingmar Bergman and Fellini and Truffaut and Kurosawa, and they had to arrange it for themselves. And then eventually that went out of existence, and then in 1973 we started it again with the same idea that there are movies that people wanted to see, and very often those were foreign films like Ingmar Bergman and directed and Kurosawa. And what I think is so interesting is that in these 52 years, as film history evolves, the way films are made, where they come from, and how they're distributed, and how we have access to them, it keeps changing. And so along with providing a film series for people in Bismarck, there we are encouraging people to think about and discuss and study that whole process. But our number one role in the past few years, and actually from the beginning, but also very strongly today, is every year we provide two film series. One in October, five films shown on Thursdays at the Grand 22 Theater in Bismarck. And then coming up in January, January 9th, we start the winter series with 10 films. And each of those is shown at twice on Thursdays, 3 o'clock and 6 o'clock at the Grand Theater, Grand 22 Theaters, actually. And the first film in that series on January 9th is a French film called Anatomy of a Fall, which received all sorts of prizes last year and was nominated for Best Picture.
Oh, we have lots to talk about for sure. And there are some great, great films in your lineup. It's just $30 for all 10 films. I think that's a wonderful value, of course. And for those of us who love movies, it's certainly a wonderful thing to do. Let's bring you in the conversation, John. Your film, Northern Lights, was it a surprise to you that it was reviewed as well as it became to be? It's the second film in this series. It'll be shown on January 16th.
Well, you know, when you make a film, you can't really think about what's going to happen later, because you're so involved in it, and particularly when you're making a low-budget film. This is my first feature film, a film set in North Dakota where I grew up. I grew up in McCluskey, and here I came back from San Francisco with a crew, and we made this low-budget black-and-white film about the Nonpartisan League, which my grandfather, by the way, was a member of. And so you take it, you know, we took it around North Dakota. We opened it in Crosby, where we shot it, and took it to all the little towns. Then we went to Bismarck and Fargo and Grand Forks, and our biggest city was Minneapolis. And it got great reviews, and we were able to make enough money to keep going. But by that time, we applied to the Cannes Film Festival, and we went there actually to try to sell it to foreign television and make some money back. We had no idea that we were going to win a fairly major prize, the Camera d'Or, which is the prize for the best first feature. And once we won that prize, then of course everything else fell into place. It was like dominoes, because now we had the imprint of the Cannes Film Festival, and it came back to the U.S. and we got bookings in every city around the country, and we got great reviews everywhere. And it was a wonderful success for our little black and white film set in North Dakota.
John, when someone sees that film today, what do you hope that they take from it?
It's the story of a very little known populist movement of farmers in North Dakota in 1915, 1916. I mean, people still don't know about it. They certainly didn't know about it when we made the film in 1978. But again, it's a film that is really from the land and from the prairie and from the people who lived there. You know, we cast a lot of local people from the Crosby area and from other parts of the state in major speaking roles. And so we mixed three actors with these farmers who at that time were still speaking a dialect of Norwegian. So we have some of it in Norwegian with subtitles. And, you know, it's a very unusual film, but sometimes it's mistaken for a documentary. It's not a documentary. It's a narrative feature. It's all fiction. It was all scripted. These farmers had to learn their lines and so on. But we used some documentary techniques. We have a narrator, Henry Martinson, who's from Fargo, the old well-known poet laureate of North Dakota, and was the deputy labor commissioner, longtime socialist who ran for state office, wonderful man. He's the narrator of the film. He was 94 at the time, and he's in the film as well. And we also used, you know, scrolling titles, which were an old technique used in documentaries. So sometimes people think, well, it's called a docudrama sometimes, but it's really it's a narrative feature, as all movies, most movies you see in cinemas. It was quite wonderful to have that success at a young age when you're getting your first film out in the world. I can't tell you how much joy it brought us all.
You were using the phrase a low-budget film, but this is an extremely beautiful movie, Northern Lights. It's beautiful to look at. And it's a real movie. There's no feeling that you're seeing something that, gee, this would be better if they had used $200 million for it. But it's an extremely beautiful movie. But John, when it comes to the money that was used to make this, wasn't that primarily a Humanities and North Dakota Humanities Council project?
Yes, we got grants from the North Dakota Humanities Council. Everett Elvers at the time was the executive director, and he gets the credit in the film as our godfather. That's what got us started. But then we, in order to bring it out into the world, and we shot the film in 16 millimeter, but we blew it up to 35 millimeter in a New York lab for its theatrical release. And we formed a limited partnership, and we raised money from them. So it was about, it ended up being about two-thirds humanities money and one-third private investment money to get it into the world.
I think that's a good example of how influential Humanities North Dakota is in North Dakota. I see myself personally as a humanities advocate. Cine 100 plays that role to some degree by encouraging people to think about their film experience, discuss it, converse about film, take a class in film. Even what we're talking about right now, Northern Lights, is probably the major film made about and in North Dakota. And that's why I use the phrase, it's a North Dakota classic film, and everyone should know it exists. And we're telling the story of where it came from.
What we're going to be seeing in Bismarck and the rest of the country when the film is being distributed widely now is a restoration, a 4K restoration of the original film. It's a whole new version of the film looks incredibly wonderful on the big screen. You know, the original film was in 35mm, which I still love, of course. This new 4K restoration is just fabulous.
We're enjoying our conversation with Brian Polacek. He's an organizer of the Cinema 100 Film Society that begins its spring line of films this Thursday, January 9th, at the Grand Theaters in Bismarck, and John Hansen, who in 1978 set out and produced what was maybe a low-budget film, but certainly a wonderful film, one of North Dakota's best, called Northern Lights. Brian, how do you choose which films are included in your lineups?
We have a board of directors, and that's a group of 8 people. And we have our fantasy lists. It's an interesting part of the whole history of how films are distributed. When we started in 1973, we would sit with the catalog, and it would have these films. There would be, let's say, 8.5 or La Dolce Vita of Fellini, and it would cost $50, and then we would order it, and it would come in a metal canister thing. And our one of our founders, Arnie Laren, who taught English at BSC, would pick it up, and then we would show it at Bismarck State College, you know, with a projector. And today it is harder to actually schedule films, to book them, because films get owned and controlled by, for example, let's say at this moment, Amazon Prime controls a certain film, or
rights management here. Yes.
You see, and so in the old days, we would come up with a fantasy list and we would just order them. And today we have to make sure that it's available. And, you know, that's made a difference. But we sit around imagining what we would like to bring, and then we work with the booker that works with the Grand 22 Theaters in Bismarck, and we come up with our list. And maybe I should just run. Is that okay?
Yeah, let's talk about your
list. I'll just run through the list. I'll just do it kind of quickly, and because I'm assuming that most people don't know these films because they're not the most famous films, but they're all well reviewed, and it's going to be an interesting series. So we start on January 9th with Anatomy of Fall, a French film, and then on January 16th, Northern Lights, directed by John Hansen, and on January 23rd, an American comedy called Between the Temples. On January 30th, The Outrun, a film with Saoirse Ronan in it. On February 6th, Anora, which is being talked about for Best Picture for the year, and it stars Mikey Madison, and everybody's saying she's going to get Oscar for Best Actress. And on February 13th, Kneecap, which is an Irish language film about an Irish language hip hop group. And on February 20th, The Stones and Brian Jones, which is a documentary relating to the Rolling Stones. On February 27th, The Convert, which is a historical drama set in New Zealand. On March 6th, Perfect Days, which is a Japanese film. And on March 13th, All We Imagine as Light, which is from India.
John, back to you. Northern Lights is not the only film you've made. You have other titles under your belt, so to speak. Tell us about some of the other movies you've made.
Well, after Northern Lights, I went up to the Iron Range, actually, to show Northern Lights, and fell in love with that area up there in the Iron Range of northern Minnesota. And I made a film called Wild Rose, which starred Lisa Eichhorn as a woman who works in these open-pit iron mines and is harassed by the men she works with, but falls in love with one of them. And he's a commercial fisherman from Bayfield, Wisconsin, who is working in the mines to make money and hates it and wants to be out in the lake. And so it's a story of their relationship against this incredible landscape of these open-pit mines with the little towns of northern Minnesota perched on the edge of these mines. And that film got wonderful success, particularly in Europe. It was the finalist for the Critics Prize at the Venice Film Festival. It was shown all over the world in many festivals. Was selected for the New Directors, New Films series at the Museum of Modern Art, and then ended up on HBO. It also was in movie theaters as well. That was released in 1984. And then following that, I was developing other projects, including one that got chosen to for the Directors Lab at the Sundance Summer Institute. Robert Redford selected a script that we had put together called Smart Money, which was set in Minneapolis, and I went there. And then I went from there to Los Angeles with Sundance's help and tried to raise money for it. And everybody said they were going to put up the money, and nobody came through with it. So that film was never made. Among a number of others that were never made, where the money would fall apart at the last minute.
Brian, we've talked about the importance of theater still today, and I want to dive into that a little bit more. When you look at it, when you take everything else away, watching a movie in a movie theater is still a pretty darn good value.
Yes, I love that. I'd like to make the point, though, that it's not that Cinema 100 is saying that you have to go to the theaters because these other ways of watching movies when you're streaming or you own a DVD or something, or your child still sticks the VHS into a machine if you have a VHS machine. But it really is worth thinking about what the theater experience means and what it's like to go to a theater to watch a film with other people and possibly even have some popcorn and some soda and a candy. And this is a really unique kind of experience. And I think it's worth, one of the things that I'd like people to think about is that in where I live in Bismarck, in Burleigh County and Morton County, there are 130,000 people living in this area. There is one theater. Now, there was a time when there was a theater in every one of the little towns, but the theater that we have, the Grand 22 Theater, is absolutely magnificent, is splendid. It has 22 screens rather than just one, you know, one theater. But this is a beautiful place. It's well run. It's clean. It looks nice. It's a very high quality theater experience. And in fact, I very often say it might be one of the nicest theaters in the world, because theaters aren't necessarily, you know, there could be small rundown little places in Jakarta. I don't know how people go to the movies in Jakarta, Indonesia, but this is a magnificent theater, and I should have made sure that people are clear that if you want to be part of the Cinema One series, you'd come to the Grand 22 Theater in Bismarck on Thursday, January 9th, and we'll be showing Anatomy of a Fall twice, once at 3 o'clock, and then you can see it also come at 6, and you'd buy your season ticket at that time. And then each of these films, the 10 films, including the Northern Lights, will be shown twice on Thursday of that date, 3 o'clock and 6 o'clock. But that, yes, theaters are, I think it's worth thinking about, having people think about, including us here, Craig and John, about our experience with theaters. Or maybe or the drive-in theater, for example, or what happens when you. I remember the first time we had a VHS machine, and the first VHS movie that I showed to our children, it was The Black Stallion, and the first movie that I rented from the store was Kagamusha, which is Japanese film. But those experiences are not just nostalgia. They're worth thinking about the ongoing processes of where movies come from and how we see them.
Brian, you may remember that my film Shimmer was also in the Cinema 100 series some years ago.
Yes, yes.
I'm wondering, as a filmmaker, things have changed so much since you made your first film. Is it hard to keep up with technology and the way that films are used today? We hear so much about computer animation. We hear so much about AI interjecting itself into the filmmaking world. As a filmmaker, what have you thought about? How have you adapted?
On one level, I mean, the first level is a distribution. You know, you used to, as Brian said, you used to deliver your films in a canister, actual film. And now they come in sometimes by satellite, but they come in by a digital file that's sent to the theater, or it comes on a hard drive. And so when we, for example, when I did the restoration of Northern Lights, we made what's called a DCP file. It's a digital cinema package, which our distributor, which is Kino Lorber, based in New York, they simply deliver that file to the theater, and the theater projects it from that. No longer do you make prints or anything. You know, prints aren't shown anymore. So you live in the digital world now when you're making films. And of course, we don't shoot on film anymore. We're shooting sometimes on iPhones. There's quite a few features shot on iPhones these days. As long as you're in the digital world, you're up in the 4K world, which is what the theaters project at 4K, high definition. You can use anything, unless you're shooting IMAX, which you know, filmmakers like me don't shoot IMAX. So we live in the digital world. We're on our computer. It's a whole new world. And of course, now with AI, I have friends who are using AI in the editing process to create images that they don't have to go out and shoot. It's just a phenomenal new world. Mm-hmm.
John, when we look at Northern Lights in 4K, will the film feel any different, or does it feel the same to you as the filmmaker?
Well, in doing the restoration, which I supervised in New York, I made sure that we didn't go too far in making the image so clean it lost its sort of grainy, wonderful feeling of a period film set on the prairie. So, you know, I had to work with the technicians who, of course, wanted to clean it up and make it, you know, make it pristine. I said, no, we want to keep this, because when you blow up with 16 millimeter to 35 millimeter, you get a little more grain. And I always loved that look. So, but what you'll see is it'll be in widescreen, and it'll be sharper. The images will be sharper, but they'll still maintain that wonderful feeling that we had. So I'm very happy with the restoration.
Brian, refresh for us now the Cinema 100 Film Society's spring list here, and how people can take advantage of the wonderful films that you offer as we wrap things up.
The 2025 film series takes place at the Grand 22 Theaters in Bismarck, and the first film is Anatomy of a Fall, French film, shown on Thursday, January 9th, followed by Northern Lights. And then we have the rest of the film, the series, the 8, and just come to the theater, and the price of the season's ticket is $30. And I do want to make the point that when we think about what we, Cinema 100, provide in the world of movie access, and I came up with this little list, and one, we provide a curated series, so that when you become a member or you buy a ticket for this, you decide, for the next 10 Thursdays, I am going to come to this theater and watch this film. This is what I'm going to watch. Rather than arguing with my spouse or partner tonight about what should we watch, and then starting it and then not finishing it, which is a very common experience. So one, a curated series. Number two, a high-quality theater experience at the Grand 22 Theaters. Number three, a very low-cost price of $30 for the 10 films. And then an opportunity to be part of a learning community, because it's part of the etiquette of Cinema 100 that you could visit with the other people as you come out of the theater or go in, because you start getting to know each other. But in normal movie going, you don't talk with people, and because it is kind of a breaking of a boundary, but that's part of the learning community aspect of Cinema 100.
Brian Polacek, he's an organizer for the Cinema 100 Film Society. The films begin this Thursday, January 9th at the Grand Theaters in Bismarck. Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And John Hansen has joined us from New Hampshire. He, in 1978, directed and produced the film Northern Lights. John, it's been a pleasure.
Yes, thank you very much, Greg. It's been a pleasure for me as well.
Coming up after the break, get ready for a blast from the past. We're talking about a film night that could have been hand-picked from your high school history teacher's ancient treasure trove. Yep, those old 16-millimeter reels that flickered and hummed their way through class are making a comeback in Barnes County. Don't touch that dial. It's retro magic right after this.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation. Proud to partner with Strengthen ND to announce the 2024 Bush Prize North Dakota winners, North Dakota Native Vote, and North Dakota Assistive. More information online at bushfoundation.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and I am pleased to be joined by Wes Anderson from the Barnes County Historical Society. They have a lecture series, season 24, that will be a 16-millimeter Film Fest with Wes Anderson. Wes, thank you for joining us again on Main Street.
Yeah, hi, Craig. Good to hear you again.
This event will be Thursday, January 16th at the Barnes County Museum. And Wes, when I read the little description that you sent to me, I thought I knew what it was, and I think I was right. It's a 16-millimeter movie night. First of all, Wes, where did you find a 16-millimeter movie projector?
Well, we run a museum here, and stuff shows up. sometimes I go looking for things. You know, I'm a technologist by nature, I guess, so I'm attracted to old mechanical stuff. And, yeah, you can't show old movies without having a projector. So, yeah, one of the later ones created. So,
you've done this before. You've went to the movie vaults that you've acquired. Where did you find these old 16-millimeter movies to show?
Well, most of these came out of the Valley City High School library, and I rescued them 20-some years ago, I suppose, from a terrible fate, and, brought them here and, kept them nice and safe, and, yeah, it's fun to bring them out and show them off once in a while.
And these are movies just like we might remember from our high school class 30 and 40 years ago, that the teacher would have just fired up in maybe a history class or another class that we would have just sat there and watched. These are those same types of movies. These weren't on the big screen downtown. These are the ones that we saw in school. Is that right?
I hate to tell you this, but 30 years ago they had VHS.
So it's longer than that. I do remember them for sure.
But yeah, you knew it was a good day when you walked in the classroom and there sat the machine at the back of the classroom aiming up at the screen in front. And yeah, they have all of these. So it was, a lot of these have Don Weiss's name on them. Don taught at BCSU history for many, many years. And so that was his department, was history, social science. And looks like a lot of these he used in his classes. So just looking at some of them is Vietnam Report, Focus on Indonesia, Focus on Communist China, Zero Draft, The Modern Young Army. And let's see, The American Presidency, Washington to Nixon, Lifting the Veil, The Tuskegee Heritage. What is the other one here? Detente, A Study with a Question Mark. And there's another one is The Moon, Going to the Moon, Apollo 7. And, I'm just picking them randomly out of a drawer here, but there's probably 100 of them to choose from, so we can do a few of these without any repetition.
Now, you've done this before. Tell me how they were received.
Oh, very well. The first time I did this was probably 10 years ago, I think. And it was mostly because, I couldn't fill the slot. And so, all right, we'll pull out the old movies. Why not? And it was very well received, but we hadn't done it for a while until last January. Yeah, it's hard to sometimes fill in the lecture positions, and so it fell to me, and all right, we'll pull out the machine. And that's what we did, and it was well received. I think we had about 25, 30 show up. We even had popcorn we made on site with an air popper, and one of my board members made some homemade root beer and brought that to share. So yeah, it should be a good evening if we do the same thing.
Now again, this will be January 16th. That's a Thursday evening at 7 o'clock at the Barnes County Museum. Wes, do you know which ones you're going to show and about how long the event will last?
Well, I think last time it was about an hour and a half. We probably showed 10 of them. So if they're 15 minutes apiece or 20, yeah, we might get into there and get a few done. But, yeah, picking random, like I said, I was reading off the labels there, and those are just the ones that I pulled out of the drawer now, and that sounds like a good combination. You never know, either that or I keep a couple in reserve and let the audience choose.
So then do you talk about the movies? Is it just, are they topical almost still today? Are they laughable? What's the environment when you show movies like this?
Oh, they're dated, that's for sure. the Vietnam ones, you know, oh, Vietnam today, 1962. And all of a sudden, Vietnam today, 1967. And Vietnam today, 1972. And okay, yeah, we're there's some of that. And dealing with China, it is in there, and Cuba, and restless neighbors to our south. And yeah, it's definitely of the era, Cold War era, mid-century. Yep, it's, you know, they are a product of their time.
Now, Wes, there's no cost to attend, is that correct?
That's correct.
What other lectures do you have planned this spring from the Barnes County Historical Society?
January, again, is the presentation on the millimeter films. Dr. Stephen King will be with us on February 20th. He's talking about Valley City, a national World War II community. Valley City has been designated as North Dakota's National World War II Community by the National Park Service. It's a new designation, and so there's a lot of amazing connections to this little town that are unlikely and helped us win the nomination, and so now we get to represent North Dakota to the National Park Service as a World War II community. It's all very exciting. So he'll be speaking on that effort and our application for that process. April 17th, I have Mid-Century Farm Life in Barnes County, an 8mm film by Peggy Peterson. This is a collection of 8mm home movies, and showing indeed the farm life as it was back in the 50s. So that's going to be a fun one.
This sounds like a fascinating evening for those of us who remember what it was like to, as you say, come into our schoolroom, see that projector, whether it was in sixth grade or whether we were in high school. I hope that you don't have to splice any of these movies when you are showing them, and I hope you're able to do it, I guess, if you have to.
Actually, I fired up the machine just now, and first one I put into there, sure enough, an old splice, the tape gave way, so I had to patch it. Yeah, that's part of the show, and a lot of these, they've not been seen for 40 years, so it's kind of a mystery of what's on there, too. But this stuff, it'll break, it'll burn, and if it gets caught in front of the light bulb too long, and it's as much a sight as sound adventure. You know, you hear the of the film going through the sprockets, and it's.
Well, Wes, I appreciate your time today. Wes Anderson has been my guest. He's with the Barnes County Historical Society. They will have a 16mm film fest. That's at 7 o'clock Thursday, January 16th at the Barnes County Museum. Wes, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Main Street continues. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In this segment from the Great American Folk Show, host Tom Brousseau takes us to Taylor, North Dakota, where the community has rallied to restore the Taylor Opera House, a cherished landmark built around 1913.
Let's journey to Stark County in western North Dakota, in the town of Taylor, population 200, and nestled in lush agriculture. The Taylor Opera House, built in 1913, stood the test of time until really not that long ago, when it was nearly condemned. But members of the community came together to save it. Today it has a new facade, it has an awning and a porch, brand new roof, and the charm and the vibe of the inside has been tastefully preserved. Emery Vaughan, one of the Opera House's caretakers, in a moment we'll get into those details. Let me just mention that one of the Opera House's most valuable features comes in the form of a scribble. That's right, you heard me. A scribble. On the back of the tin stage wall, and again on the original backdrop, are hundreds, no, thousands of signatures from the people who have performed there over the years and the national acts that have traveled through. Like Lloyd Fixon, I saw his name, he signed it in 1936. and the Taylor Senior Class play. All of them signed it in 1942. George Brague, I'm not sure who he is, but I bet you that folks listening in Taylor right now, they'll recognize that name. George signed it in 1951. And it was really hard not to fall upon one signature in particular, Newman, the popular hypnotist and mind reader who performed there in 1925 and then again in 1928 to standing room only. Hey, what can I say other than it is a beautiful thing when someone stands up to preserve something. Emery, welcome to the Great American Folk Show.
Thank you. Glad to be on.
Born and raised in Taylor, North Dakota.
That's right. Born and raised in Taylor, North Dakota. I was gone for about 20 years and moved back and got pretty active in the community again. And here we go. We redid our opera house. My dad was a postmaster in Taylor. My kids are sixth generation in this area. So this is the Taylor Opera House. When we started remodeling the opera house, back in 2019, there was a lot of discrepancy on when this building was built, and I think I found the most definitive proof. They started probably in April of 1912. We tried to keep it as original as possible, yet still make it safe and very functional by today's standards.
And to what purpose was the Opera House built all those years ago? And we have many opera houses here in the state of North Dakota, and other states do too. But what's the Opera House used for back then?
You know, I got to believe it was for community gatherings, dances, different things like that. We still have the original stage curtain. And if we drop that down, we can see that there was a traveling show that stopped in here in 1913. There's a lot of different shows that have been here back up to the 40s that they would come in, put on a performance or two, and sign the back of our stage curtain.
I was just going to ask you, how did you know that date? But it's because these productions that would come through would actually sign and date the back of the backdrops there on the stage.
Absolutely, yeah. It's really cool. You go up there, you can look at all the tins up on the stage, and you get a sense of the real history of this building.
So we're up on the stage now, and it's a curious thing. As you get closer and closer to the wall, what pops out?
Well, right now I'm looking at Beatrice Elkin. Was in a play in 1941, April 1st. James Gallagher was in a play in 1938. It seems like every 6 inches you'll find a name of a former high schooler that performed in a play on the stage here, and they... It's just fascinating.
I see a Sherwood Christensen, 1945. My gosh, it looks like this was written almost just yesterday.
Yeah, it's very cool. When the families come back here, when the lighting is really good, they're all like looking for their relatives, and it's really kind of neat.
Well, I must admit that is pretty special, because here their relatives were up on the stage signing a performance. After a performance, and so what a touching thing for relatives to come up here and see that penmanship and see that date. My gosh, as much as this is a community space, it's also a museum. It's also a record of the past.
Oh, definitely. I'd like to drop this curtain that we have here and show you. It's fascinating to see the traveling shows that were here, and they talk about how many people were in this show and the dates, and then when they returned several years later and performed here again.
Never in a million years would I ever think, and I'm standing right now, I have to do this. This is such a beautiful spot, hardwood floor, hardwood walls, but then over here by the kitchen, you see these little black marks, and those are cigarette burns.
Absolutely, yeah. I guess I just flicked them over there and hope for good luck or whichever.
So what happens in the Taylor Opera House these days?
A lot of family reunions. You know, well, there's a myriad of events that really happen. The bank hosts a barbecue here or something like that. It's fairly well booked. We're hoping to start having some shows in here.
What did it take to get the Taylor Opera House back into this condition, which is to say absolutely beautiful? What did that take, and who was it that was part of that?
Well, it was myself. I was on the city council, and I'd kind of brought up the idea of, well, maybe we should save it. And so I immediately became the guy to kind of work on that. But the truth of the matter is there was about seven gals in the community that we got together, and they started going getting money. We started talking about what do we want to do, and it seemed like it came together really fast. We were able to fundraise quite a bit of money, and we hired a local contractor that kind of put in a lot of the niceties, made it secure, added the front porch on, which that was never there before. I think it's a wonderful facility.
Was it in jeopardy of being condemned or demolished?
There was definitely enough people that thought, you know, just get rid of it. And I wanted to see this place be part of my kids' chance to come and experience the Opera House. We used to have Christmas Day here. Santa would come and there'd be baskets handed out. And I just think that we got to keep that going.
Well, Emery Vaughan, thank you so much for being on the Great American Folk Show. I've just enjoyed my visit here. I can't wait to jump up on that stage and see some of the backdrops. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you for coming.
That was Tom Rousseau, host of the Great American Folk Show. You can stream current and past episodes at prairiepublic.org and tune in for new episodes every Sunday at 5 p.m. Central right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In this Plainsfolk essay titled Second Sight, Dr. Tom Ezern explores the practice of water witching or dousing on the Northern Plains. While many settlers relied on dowsers to locate water, the practice drew skepticism from both scientists and the press.
Although water witching or dousing, the location of underground water resources by use of a willow wand or some other sort of divining rod, was common in the settler society of the Northern Plains, the practice had its contemptuous critics. And not only among the scientific fraternity. In 1907, the Jamestown Alert cautioned the public that persons plying devices of divination were hoodwinking uneducated people. Some of the dowsers, they said, were perfectly honest in their beliefs. They could tap into electrical energy to locate water. But it only worked where there was plenty of water to be found thereabouts. In 1901, the press of Dickerson reported one local citizen had his wrist severely wrenched while exploring for water with a dowser, and another received a terrific shock. In all seriousness, the editor called on the legislature to ban water witching in the interest of public safety. "Why is it," asked the sophisticated Fargo Forum in 1911, "that every farmer employs a water witch before digging a well? Every neighborhood has its man with second sight and the power to charm away warts. Usually, he is also the water witch. Of course, water is usually found. It can be found almost anywhere if a well is sunk deep enough. Like the phrenologist and the clairvoyant, the dowser goes triumphantly onward, heralded as a man of supernatural powers." Well, the dowsers themselves claimed no supernatural status. They said they tapped into natural forces. They advertised their services, as did J.A. Johnson from near Jamestown, who boasted of the fine wells he had located and declared, "I can convince almost anybody that water can be located by use of a steel water witch." Likewise, John Baldson over at Osnabrück was a celebrated dowser. And these are just examples of known and respected practitioners across the country. Baldson was an old settler, had come to Cavalier County from Ontario in 1886, had held multiple local offices, and was a Republican state legislator. He was no quack. The discussion continued, In 1944, an official of the State Board of Health condemned dowsers for inflicting drudgery on farm wives. Often, he alleged, they recommended location of a well distant from the farmhouse, when one could just as well have been secured nearby, thus saving the labor of fetching in water. The town of Fessenden had a dispute in the late 1940s when the town fathers relied on a water witch to locate a city well, which, although good for a brief time, soon was depleted, and they had to secure water via a pipeline run out to Heimdall. One of my Bright University students recently has been going through records in the university archives of folklore collections made in the 1980s. She finds that when researchers interviewed water witches, the lessons quickly turned into how-to tutorials. I am certain that today, within the sound of my voice, there are believers and practitioners of water witching, listening and nodding.
That's our great friend, Dr. Tom Easern. He's a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University, and we're grateful that he contributes his Plains Folk essays to our listeners here at Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 6th. The 12th day of Christmas, or 12th night, is known as King's Day at Turtle Mountain. In Catholic tradition, it is the Feast of Epiphany, honoring the three wise men who traveled to Bethlehem to see the Christ child. A boy born on this day at Turtle Mountain was entitled to the name King, in addition to his given name. King Summer was a full-blooded Chippewa who went by no other first name. Other notable individuals named King include tribal councilman Gregory Real King Davis and musician Eddie King Johnson. King's Day marked the end of the New Year's celebration, a week of feasting, dancing, and visiting. The sound of sleigh bells rang through the cold air as families visited elders, relatives, and neighbors, wishing them la bonne année. At midnight on January 1st, gunshots fired into the sky signaled the start of the festivities. Some households continued the nightly salute. One neighbor would shoot his gun twice at midnight and yell, la bonne année. Fiddle music and French songs were common at many homes. Furniture was moved aside to make room for waltzing, square dancing, and the lively Red River Jig, a mix of indigenous and European steps. Mary Jane Davis recalled that the dancing continued until 5 or 6 in the morning, with no drinking or fighting, just people enjoying each other's company. Visiting elders and relatives was the central focus of the celebration, as families were often isolated by snow until spring. Elders were served first, and the table was cleared and reset until the younger guests ate all they could. The New Year feast featured bullets and bangs, French terms for meatballs and fry bread, along with light bread made with yeast and baking powder bread known as gullet. Bullets were rolled into flour and cooked in a pot, often with potatoes and onions. Toucare, a ground pork pie with wild cranberry sauce, might also be served, along with fresh butter, home-canned wild berry sauce, or preserves. There were also raisin pies, Juneberry pies, and home-canned peaches and plums. Rita Gernot remembered visiting her great-aunt's house after her grandfather's. She wrote, "As soon as we got to Aunt Maggie's, we were seated at the table, even though we had just come from the previous meal. For once, we ate small portions and hoped we wouldn't be urged to eat pie." Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lisa Erdrich. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
That's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you have spent part of your day with us. Tomorrow, we'll sit down with Corey Peterson, Director of Health and Human Services, Children and Family Services, to discuss kinship care, an approach that keeps families connected while safeguarding the well-being of children. It's an important conversation you won't want to miss. Join us tomorrow, right back here on Main Street.